Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Moscow to speak with the independent defense analyst Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer about the growing possibility that Putin will order his army that is massing on the border with Ukraine to invade eastern Ukraine under the guise of liberating Russian-speaking Ukrainians from a Western-backed government of Nazis and anti-Semites who are oppressing pro-Russian Ukrainians. We will look into the possibility Putin will move to annex the Russian. He will also move to annex the Russian-speaking separatist Transnistria region of Moldova, and his ominous warning to Russians opposed to him, who Putin labeled in a speech to the Russian parliament as a fifth column and a disparate bunch of national traitors. Then we will speak with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, who shared the Nobel Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We will discuss his new article at Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036, and the recent Senate all-nighter on climate change, the White House's new website on climate change, and Hillary Clinton's remarks to students at Arizona State University that she hopes there will be a mass movement that demands political change to address global warming. Then finally, we will speak with a scientist who predicted the recent Big Bang breakthrough in 1983 that is now confirmed with new evidence of how the universe underwent rapid expansion a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Andre Linde, a professor of physics at Stanford University, whose chaotic inflation theory has been verified by a team of scientists at the South Pole, joins us to discuss the significance of this discovery that has rocked the world of science, heralding in a whole new era of physics. Joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences from 1994 to 2005. And Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local international publications. And we spoke recently, and you were suggesting that there could be a possibility of an invasion of eastern Ukraine. Now, Russian forces are, according to NATO, are in a very ready state. There's also talk of a possibility of invading a part of Moldova called Transnistria. Let's start with eastern Ukraine. Do you think that's on the table?
Well, there's a rather high possibility of Russian troops going in right now. Well, right now, meaning most likely I would bet second half of April. That would be, of course, very important to know the exact weather conditions, because Russian Air Force does not have the capability of effectively supporting ground troops in bad weather or night. So that would be also one of the essentials. Of course, also we had a very mild winter in Ukraine and Russia this year, little snow, and the spring is warm and early, so the soil is drying up, which will allow tank forces to move away from roads and kind of spread out if need be.
So,
and also, of course, as it has been said and noted by NATO commander Sakur, Russian troops are in a heightened state of readiness, which is true, but this state of readiness is going to soon evaporate, because on the 1st of April, Russia begins the so-called spring call-up of conscripts, which means that those conscripts, 130,000 of them actually, that served 1 year, and they're more or less trained and ready to, for action, and that are right now massed, in fact, on the Ukrainian borders, will have to be mustered out. Well, we can keep them for at least maybe a couple of months, but then they'll become restless and anyway have to be mustered out. And, of course, it's very essential for Russia to prevent the planned elections in Ukraine, national elections on May 25th. Which could legitimize a government that Moscow hates. So I believe, taking into account all these factors, that the time frame for a serious Russian operation in southern Ukraine especially, where the soil is good right now for action, would be most likely April, most likely second half of April, but maybe a bit earlier, and the time frame finishes maybe May 10 or something like that, May 15. In this time frame, I believe that the possibility of Russian action is about more than 80%.
And when you say the time frame would be finished, would that mean Russian tanks would be in Kyiv?
I mean, that's if we don't go, that means there is no war.
I see.
Because a comparable state of military readiness will be achieved by the Russian military only in August, September, no earlier. When new conscript, because, I mean, after the mustering out, we'll be left with conscript that served half a year or zero.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And to train up the troops, we'll need at least, well, to August, maybe September. Also, the problem is that Ukrainians are trying to put their military into some fighting shape. Of course, right now, that's being hampered by administrative mayhem. They're also trying to put into working condition their heavy weapons, their tanks, their guns, their jets. And Ukraine has enormous amounts of heavy weaponry, but most of it's in storage and is not good for use, but it can be restored since the Ukrainians have the expertise, also civilian expertise. They have a rather vast defense industry. So if they're given time to mobilize volunteers to reinforce their forces, so by August, September, they can put up a very serious fight. So right now, the Ukrainians are weak, the Russians are strong, but this will not last. This ends somewhere in May. That means it's going now or not going at all.
And what is going on with Transnistria? Is that
Transnistria is important because there's a small Russian garrison there that's cut off. It's Transnistria is a landlocked enclave sandwiched between Moldova and Ukraine. And if we have anti-Russian kind of government in Kyiv, a government not very friendly, that leaves the Russian interest and Russian small garrison in Transnistria cut flowers. I mean, they can't survive without Ukraine allowing military transport in and out. Maybe the government could allow it for some time, but if we'll continue to be on a kind of war footing with Ukraine, apparently someday they'll say that they had enough and won't allow military flights or land military connections, logistic connections to this garrison, and we lose it. So I would believe Russia would want to expand from Crimea, taking the entire south of Ukraine, border that's close to the Black Sea and Azov Sea. That means Donbas, that means Kherson, Nikolaev, Odessa, and then, of course, in the end, we reach Transnistria.
So are the Spetsnaz, the special forces, are they overstretched in Crimea? Because I understand...
Well, they've done their work already. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have that much of them. Mm-hmm. So we'll need them, of course, other places.
I see.
And actually, in Crimea, they were mostly not Spetsnaz, but, I mean, they were in the first wave, obviously, mm-hmm. special forces. But later on came ordinary conscripts, 18-year-old kids.
So what do we make, though?
Because they are the kind of, they fill up the brigades of the Russian military, including the VDV, paratroopers, and the Marines, mostly their conscripts.
So we don't know how these conscripts are going to feel fighting Ukrainians.
Morale most likely is rather good after the successful Crimea campaign, where there was no real fighting. Mm-hmm. I believe the Russian leadership, including military leadership, would hope that there will be no fighting, that this will be just a kind of armistice excursion. That Ukrainians are waiting, Russian-speaking Ukrainians are just eager to see the Russian troops in as liberators.
Well, there are...
And, of course, and that's a fact that Ukrainian military, though they're struggling to regain some fighting capability, are still rather weak. But if we allow them to continue to muster up their forces, they can become stronger and stronger and stronger.
So what about these...
Well, we were actually, in the coming several months, will become weaker and weaker, Russians.
I see.
And this means that there's a very high temptation to go now,
so,
political and especially military speaking.
But Dr. Pavel Felkinow, already there are these so-called political tourists going in from Russia into eastern Ukraine. Are they meant to be provocateurs? Are they laying the groundwork?
Well, of course there's Russian provocateurs. In Crimea, there were the so-called self-defense forces, the Cossacks, were actually most of them were imported from Russian regions, from Kuban, from Volgograd, from other places, Stavropol, to pose as locals who want to unite with Russia. Which is, of course, normal procedure in any kind of campaign. You flood the enemy territory with different kind of provocateurs and diversionists and so on. Especially if you have they are Russian speakers and both sides are Russian speakers, you can kind of do that and it works.
But what happens when Russians start killing Ukrainians? Will that affect the patriotic fervor that's at a high pitch now in Russia?
Well, no one knows for sure before it happened. Mm-hmm. Happens, if it happens. It's not 100% probability. So I would say it's about 80% that we go in en masse soon. It depends, of course, very much on how the Ukrainians will put their act together. Will they put up a serious fight, or will they just simply disintegrate? If they disintegrate, then Russia takes on big chunks of Ukrainian territory. I think it would be seen as a great victory for Vladimir Putin. If we run into resistance and begin getting serious losses, that would be a very serious internal political problem for the regime. So it depends mostly right now. The unknown factor is how the Ukrainians will react, and are they really ready to fight or are they not? And I don't, being in Moscow, don't know that at all for sure.
Sure. Well, being in Moscow, where there was a big demonstration a week ago, I was very disturbed by some of what Vladimir Putin said in his speech to the Duma. Just quoting here, some Western politicians are already threatening us with not just sanctions, but also the prospect of increasingly serious problems on the domestic front. I would like to know what it is they have in mind exactly. Action by a fifth column, this disparate bunch of...
Well, of course, as always in a military kind of situation, warlike situation, there's going to be censorship. And there's going to be arrest of people who the authorities believe are enemy agents because maybe they're pacifists or they don't want to support Russia going into Ukraine and reuniting regions that the Kremlin believes are Russian. So, yes, of course, there's going to be suppression of any kind of anti-war expression. That's part of the deal. But that will most likely happen even if we don't go.
Right.
Yes, of course, there's very serious pressure on the Russian media, what's left of the uncensored media, because most of it is just right now very jingoistically beating the war drum.
And you're
about
with,
great Russian victories and so on. Though, of course, I mean, the official line is that there is no war, that we are just simply, this is just kind of, we are uniting with our brothers. Well, that's what people always say. I mean, authorities always say in any war.
Right, but you're with...
Especially when it begins.
Sure. But you're with the opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the last and only, I think, outlets that are not controlled by Putin. When he refers to this fifth column, this disparate bunch of national traitors, do you feel that he's referring to you?
Oh, sure.
Well, how does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel threatened and rather depressed in a situation when things may go really out of hand. Actually, to put it bluntly, the possibility of all-out nuclear war is not zero.
Under what scenario would that happen? Because
Escalation means escalation. If you go into military escalation, you never know where you can actually stop.
Right.
And say if Russia encounters some serious resistance, and Ukrainian military do have some rather Soviet-style but still powerful weapon systems, and, of course, they're Cold War stuff, but the Russian military is also basically equipped with Cold War stuff. And we could run into serious losses and, say, Russian, say, warship is sunk by an Ukrainian jet bomber in the Black Sea. And Russia would claim that that was actually not Ukrainian missile, but an American missile released by an American jet. And Russia, if Russia runs into serious military problems in this very adventurous possible move into deeper into Ukraine, it could claim that it's not the Ukrainians that are killing Russian child soldiers, but 18-year-old kids, but it's the Americans. There'd be talk that the Americans already secretly deployed special forces fighting Russians, American stealth jets attacking us. Any possibility is possible. I'm not saying it's a high possibility, but it's not zero. This escalating into a direct confrontation between Russia and the West, a military confrontation. It's not zero. And that could, of course, basically, in the end, possibly, again, it's not zero possibility, but small but not zero, into an all-out exchange of nuclear weapons. We're in a rather dire strait, I would say.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, given that possibility, what does NATO do? I mean, do they sit on their hands? I mean, that sounds like the smartest thing to do, but it's not the most likely thing to do. They're likely to increase more sanctions on Russia. There's more going to be more condemnation. I mean, the irony is, of course,
well, sanctions, that's not NATO's job. NATO's job is to kind of try and deploy some kind of observer force, especially in the Baltics. Again, there's a possibility to have to supply Ukrainian forces with non-lethal supplies, and they're actually mostly right now low on such supplies. I mean, they have thousands of tanks and guns, though, of course, most of them are not in full battle readiness, but they can use them, especially if they have time to work maintenance. But what they don't have is boots, socks, field fatigues, body armor, Kevlar helmets, medical kits, communication equipment, and such stuff. That's what the Ukrainian military say, that's what they don't have.
Right.
Rations.
Right.
Non-lethal stuff.
Right.
That they would very much need to put themselves into some kind of fighting position. So NATO could supply that.
Right.
NATO countries, of course, not NATO itself.
Right. Well, but just in the meantime, what we're left with is that Putin is riding high in the polls. As long as he rattles the war drums and threatens war, he's incredibly popular in Russia. He may go into eastern Ukraine in mid-April and try and get it over with earlier, but it could go through the summer. So I guess this is all about Putin. This is not necessarily about Russia, is it?
Well, it's Putin, but there's a lot of revisionists here in Russia who'd want to restore the Soviet Union. Up to now, Putin was kind of staying, at least openly, not siding with them. Now he is. Mm-hmm. And this is such revisionism is rather popular, at least in quite some circles, that Russia should regain its world standing as a superpower. So it's working okay until we run into serious trouble, until sanctions begin to bite. Ukrainian excursion, if it happens, turns out to be a bloody mess, a quagmire. And then, of course, the popularity of any government, including Putin's, will begin to tumble.
Well, I think
so. Going into Ukraine is, of course, deeper into Ukraine right now, though it's tempting. It's a high-risk strategy.
Well, it's difficult to know how much Putin, how cynical Putin is, how he's trying to distract the Russian people from his own.
Well, it's not, I think, a distraction. He's sitting in the Kremlin, okay.
Right.
There's no problem.
Right.
I mean, it's more like Saddam Hussein going into Kuwait in August 1990. I mean, if he didn't do that, he'd be still most likely ruling Iraq from one of his 200 palaces and traveling between them.
Sure, but is anybody in Russia...
Instead of being in a shallow grave.
But is that...
Sometimes dictators don't figure out what's their real good.
Well, that was my final question. Does anybody in the Kremlin inner circle, are they advising Putin? Is he getting any advice to be cautious? He doesn't listen to his generals, does he? He listens to his KGB cronies.
Well, generals can only say, well, yes, there are problems, but we're ready to go. What else a general can say?
Right.
If we're not ready to go, then he should resign.
Right.
So, and they're not ready for that.
Right. But so are you confident that Putin's getting any cautious advice or advice to be cautious?
Well, he has been always a cautious. Putin has always been a cautious politician up to now.
I see.
But maybe he being so long in power and everyone saying what a genius he is all of the time. He, as it happens again with dictators, especially those who rule for a long time, is losing contact with reality. Apparently, the German Chancellor, Merkel, just what she said.
Right. Well, he's
out. After talking to him, that he's not very fully in full contact with reality. And I would believe that's just what's happening.
Right. And, of course, his chief aide warned that these sanctions, he talked about the boss, as they call him, that this is going to, you can't back the boss into a corner. That was his warning. So it's a pretty dangerous time that we're in here, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. From 1994 to 2005, Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. In 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joined us from Moscow. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about a leading expert on climate change and his article in the Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. He has an article at the Scientific American Earth will cross the climate danger threshold by 2036. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
And there's three things I wanted to talk about. Well, obviously, your article. I also want to talk about the recent Senate all-nighter on climate change, the White House's new website on climate change, and Hillary Clinton's remarks to students at Arizona State University that she hopes there will be a mass movement that demands political change to address global warming. So why don't you just take them in whatever order you want.
The full plate.
Right.
So, we could start out talking about this article in Scientific American that it's now out on the website, and it's in the April print issue of Scientific American, so it should be at the newsstands shortly. It addresses an issue that has gotten a lot of attention over the past year or so, the issue of the so-called pause in global warming. In fact, I originally wanted to title the article Faux Pause, False Pause, because there really isn't a pause in global warming, despite what you might gather from reading certain news sites or from following discussions of the issue in the mainstream media, the public discourse. So it has to do with the fact that the globe has not warmed as much over the past 10 years or so as some models suggest that it should have. And it turns out that there are a number of reasons for that. We understand quite well that the most likely explanation of that is the fact that there has been some volcanic activity, which is a cooling factor that wasn't completely taken into account in the models, a small dip in the amount of energy coming in from the sun, and just sort of the vagaries of natural random climate variability. We've had a number of large La Nina events. La Nina is the flip side to the El Nino phenomenon. And during La Ninas, the globe is a little bit cooler than it otherwise would be. And so if you have a number of those events over a 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, it can actually lower the average temperature of that period, and it can dampen the warming. And the fundamental point here is that nothing that's happened in the past 10 years in any way changes the forecast for the future. And what I show in this article is that even if you are take into account all of the various factors that might lead the climate to be a little bit less sensitive to greenhouse gases than the IPCC's best estimate, even if you take into account the possibility that the climate is a little bit less sensitive to our pumping of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you come up with the conclusion that we will commit to 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet, roughly 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet within a matter of 2 or at most 3 decades. And if the climate sensitivity, as the critics like to try to argue, was lower than what the IPCC says it's most likely to be by, say, 0.5 degree C, which would be sort of an extreme scenario, it would assume that the so-called pause, the faux pause, is somehow indicative of a climate that is less sensitive to greenhouse gases. Even if we take that into account, we're still a matter of 3 decades at most from crossing that 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit threshold. That is a threshold that most scientists studying the impacts of climate change have concluded is where we really start to commit ourselves to the most dangerous and potentially irreversible impacts on our climate. So the point of this piece, which ended up being called False Hope, is that the so-called pause, the speed bump in global warming of the past 10 years, is no cause for decreased concern about our ongoing warming of the planet. And in many respects, as we can see with the rapid melting of Arctic sea ice, we are actually proceeding ahead of schedule in terms of the impacts of climate change that we're seeing and the damage that's already having. So those were the points made by this piece, and I would encourage people to check it out. Again, it should be at the newsstands either now or shortly, the April issue of Scientific American.
Well, there's a tendency, though, surely, Michael Mann. After all, Al Gore called his film The Inconvenient Truth about climate change, and you have these active global warming deniers funded by billionaires like the Koch brothers and others, who are actively trying to spread disinformation and slow down efforts to address this looming problem. And then I think there's a natural tendency in most people not to want to hear bad news, and in many ways to blame the messenger.
That's right. And, you know, the real damage that this disinformation campaign does to our discourse is it sort of gives reasonable people an excuse for neglecting a problem that they really cannot afford to neglect. You know, we have so many problems, issues that we all have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, that if we're told that climate change is somehow a very far-off problem or less of a problem than we've been led to believe, it's quite understandable that reasonable people will sort of lower the climate change issue. They'll sort of push that down on their list of priorities, on the things that they're concerned about and the things that they demand action on. And so when, you know, we hear that climate change is an overblown problem, that it's not as bad as we thought, that message is not faithful to what the scientific evidence indicates. The evidence indicates that's a real problem. If we don't do something about it soon, it will become a catastrophic problem. But there has been so much misinformation and disinformation that it's led to confusion. And that's what the critics, the professional climate change deniers, often, as you know, tied to fossil fuel interests or right-wing interests like the Koch brothers, that's what they're seeking to do. They're seeking to cloud the public discussion. They're seeking to confuse the public so that they just throw up their hands, so that we throw up our hands and say, well, you know, some scientists say it's a problem, others say it isn't. You know, I'm not going to worry about it. It's still, you know, there's no consensus about this problem. I'm going to focus on other things, bread and butter, you know, issues that that are influencing me on a daily basis. And that would be wrongheaded, because the fact is that climate change is what's called by some a threat multiplier. All of the problems that we deal with, whether it's food, human health, access to fresh water, national security, all of these things will be very negatively impacted by climate change if we don't do something about it and immediately.
Well, not to blame the Koch brothers for everything, I think you can also blame one of the greatest villains of all in climate change denial is Rupert Murdoch, whose News Corporation, the second biggest investor in the News Corporation, their family-owned business, a short of the Murdoch family, is the kingdom fund of the royal family of Saudi Arabia. And we know what interests they have in selling oil. So the whole thing is deeply cynical. What did you make then of Hillary Clinton's call to action with the students at Arizona State University that they should form a mass movement demanding political change?
Well, I thought that was great, actually. I think that one of the ways that change is most likely to come is through pressure, public pressure, especially, you know, exerted by those who are most passionate about this issue, who understand that this is really about their future. And one of the things that gives me great optimism when I travel around and I lecture about the climate change crisis is the fact that I meet so many younger folks, college students, people in their 20s or early 30s, who get it. They understand that this is a real problem, that it's not some distant, far-off issue, that it's something that's influencing them now and is going to become ever more problematic if we don't do something about it. And they realize it's about their future. They realize that it's about making the decisions now that we need to make so that we don't leave behind a fundamentally degraded planet for the next generation and the generation beyond that. So one of the ways that, you know, college students have historically influenced the public dialogue is by, you know, movements organized around college campuses. And right now, Bill McKibben of the organization 350.org is leading an effort to get universities, colleges and universities, to try to divest themselves of, you know, stocks in those companies who are actively financing a climate change disinformation effort. And I think that that is a critical way of exerting pressure on corporations and companies that unfortunately in some cases have not acted in the public interest and are instead acting in their own near-term self-interest.
Well, Michael Mann, I recently spoke with Senator Bernie Sanders on the eve of the Senate all-nighter that took place about a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't heard any follow-through on what happened as a result of the Senate staying up all night to discuss and debate climate change.
Well, I think that it was an effort to draw some attention to, an issue which doesn't often get as much attention as it really deserves, given, the existential threat that it ultimately presents to us. And unfortunately, there was not as much media coverage of that event as one might have expected and hoped, and that is part of the problem. It's been difficult to get sort of mainstream media organizations to cover climate change with the prominence that it deserves. And part of that, I think, is the fact that it's, unlike a lot of, issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, it is a slow but steady mounting problem. It is a problem that emerges over years and decades at a time. And historically, we're not great at dealing with slowly mounting problems in the same way that, the supposed frog who in the water that slowly, the temperature slowly heated up to the boiling point doesn't jump out because it's only sensitive to abrupt changes. We can't afford to wait for, catastrophic events, more Hurricane Sandys or more summers like those we've seen in recent years in the U.S., where we've had massive drought and unprecedented heat that's destroyed our crops, that has led to massive wildfires in the western U.S. We can't wait until climate change becomes a full-blown catastrophe to act on this problem, because if we do, we will have already ensured decades and centuries of even greater warming and climate change and sea level rise into the future. It's a very pernicious problem in that it has a procrastination penalty unlike just about any other problem that we've dealt with, where the actions we take now with our energy choices, with our emission of carbon into the atmosphere, those actions have a legacy of decades and even centuries in terms of the climate change that we're putting into the pipeline.
So, Michael Mann, what do you make of the White House's new website on climate change?
Well, I think it's great that, the White House, that the executive branch has taken a high-profile and a very sort of forceful approach to trying to confront the climate change crisis over the past year or two. The president, of course, is engaged in some executive actions like placing, the EPA placing restrictions on the carbon emissions standards for coal-fired power plants, putting in incentives for clean, non-fossil fuel-based energy. The executive branch really has done, just about all you could ask of it, given that we have this intransigence right now in our Congress. I mean, what we really need is a comprehensive climate bill, but we have a House of Representatives that's led by a group of Republicans that doesn't even accept that climate change exists. So there really aren't any short-term prospects for legislative action. And so that's forced the president to use what levers are available to him to do what he can. And I applaud the president for having done that. Now, that having been said, as we all know, there's a very critical decision that is coming up. That is the decision over whether or not the administration will approve the Keystone XL pipeline. Many of us think that that would be a very bad idea. It would lock in additional carbon emissions, very dirty carbon tar sands oil, very inefficient, very expensive, and very dirty from a climate standpoint heavy carbon footprint form of fossil fuel energy. If we are to, if we build that pipeline, we're going to ensure the burning of many more gigatons, billions of tons of carbon, and the climate change that that will create. And the president, in a State of the Union address earlier this year, said that he doesn't want to look back and have to, answer to his, children and grandchildren why we had the power to act, to do something about the problem, and we failed to do so. He doesn't want to have to be in a position to look back and do that and say that. And if he means his word, then many of us feel that he cannot approve the Keystone XL pipeline. So that'll be a real critical test as to how serious the administration really is about the climate change problem.
Well, just in closing, Michael Mann, before we went on the air, I spoke with an expert on satellite oceanography. Obviously, I was trying to find out about these new satellite pictures from the Indian Ocean looking for the missing Malaysian airliner. He pointed out that the instrumentation that they have from satellites is extraordinarily accurate, and that one of the big issues, of course, is the temperature of the ocean below 2,000 meters. How accurate these readings are that they can get from satellites. And it leads me to the conclusion that scientists are by nature very conservative. They don't jump out ahead of themselves. It's such an absurdity to suggest that somehow a bunch of scientists are making up stuff about climate change when, one, the instrumentation now is so accurate,
right,
and two, scientists by nature are conservative.
Well, it's a great point. I think I can tie it all in together in a coherent way, because, in fact, one of the ways that we're able to measure sea level rise is through these extremely precise satellite measurements. We can actually measure very small changes in the height of the sea surface. We can measure changes in the amount of ice stored in the ice sheets. We can measure fairly subtle changes in how much ice is stored in the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And so it's these very precise satellite measurements that have actually led to the conclusion that the ice is melting. The major ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, are losing mass ahead of schedule, earlier than we expected them to. They are contributing to sea level rise earlier than we expected them to. And so, indeed, this is an example of where, if you look at the projections that climate scientists had made, for example, in the previous IPCC reports, they were too conservative. The observations are telling us that the ice is melting faster than the scientists said it should just a decade ago, and that sea level is rising faster than we expected it to. So, indeed, we have very precise, increasingly precise measurements. There's a lot of really fascinating and rewarding science that's involved in the detective work of figuring out how we can take those measurements and turn them into estimates of sea level rise and estimates of how much ice is locked in the ice sheets. And that data that's coming in tells us that climate change, in many respects, is unfolding faster, that it's a bigger problem than we thought even a decade ago.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. He has an article at the New Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the scientist who predicted the recent Big Bang breakthrough in 1983.
It's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andre Linde, who's a professor of physics at Stanford University, who in 1983 was the first to describe the chaotic inflation theory, which has just been confirmed with new evidence of how the universe underwent rapid expansion a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Linde.
Thank you so much.
And this discovery that you discovered or wrote about back in 1983 and predicted is now being heralded as a whole new era in physics. So give us a sense of why the detection of the primordial gravitational waves, the first tremors of the Big Bang, have so much significance.
Well, first of all, independently of the theory which I helped to develop, it's important to check general theory of relativity, which Einstein have proposed 100 years ago. He predicted that the space and time have degrees of freedom of their own. If you, well, wave your hand, in addition to everything that you see, you also perturb space and time, and gravitational waves are generated which go through it. It's like electromagnetic waves, which are produced when you shake electron, and then you have radio station and somebody else pick up radio waves and listen what you say. So the same things could happen with gravity. Gravitational waves could propagate. Now, these particular gravitational waves have been produced in the Big Bang, and not just in the Big Bang, but according to a specific version of the theory which make this bang big. The previous version of the Big Bang theory was such that you have like a huge explosion, like some terrorist exploded lots of dynamite, and it was not big enough to make our universe as large as it is right now, and also it would be very clumpy, very not the way it is as we see it right now. So somewhere in the 80s, a new theory was proposed, inflationary theory. And in 83, I proposed the version which seemed to work. It is chaotic inflation. It predicts these gravitational waves, which should have been originated from approximately 1 trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, which is like science fiction. The whole story which we studied and suggested at that time looked like science fiction of the worst kind, because we learned how to produce the whole universe, what we see right now, from less than 1 milligram of matter. This, if somebody would tell me something like that, well, 40 years ago, I would tell the person, go home and return to me next morning when you're not drunk. But then when we learned how to actually do it, we cannot unlearn it. And if these experimental results are correct, then this nearly science fiction theory is, well, on a very good footing from the point of view of confirmation.
But apparently we're talking about here, the significance of this discovery is that the two great theories of physics, general relativity and quantum mechanics, could show a way to join these two theories together that would then this latest information could show a way to join these two theories together that would produce what some people have called the theory of everything.
Yeah, I hope very much so. We are still, even these, discoveries which we are making right now, even in this respect, we need to go still further with energies to really, match this synthesis of two great science. But nevertheless, we're already probing quantum theory of gravity, not just gravity, not just the theory which was invented by Einstein, but the quantum theory of gravity. And so far, experimental data confirm what we suggested. Just to tell you some numbers for understanding, the most powerful accelerators which were built by people on Earth, which cost about $10 billion to build, they produce particles with maximum energy
almost, approximately a billion times smaller than the energies which we can study right now, looking on the sky, spending a thousand times less money.
That's what they call the God particle, right?
Oh, the God particle is something which people found at LHC. This is the Higgs particle.
Mm-hmm.
The particles which are responsible for inflation probably are different. But nevertheless, their nature is probably very similar to the nature of the particle which was found at LHC in Geneva. Physics is similar, scales are totally different. This is much more energy in these particles. They have much, much greater mass. They cannot be produced, I think. According to the most popular theories, they cannot be produced at Earth accelerators.
So why then, just for the layperson, could this discovery that you were the first to indicate, Andre, why are people calling it the theory of everything? What does it explain in terms of everything?
Well, the theories of everything, probably it does not really apply to the theories of inflation. Inflation is sometimes used what these people call theories of everything. But inflation tells you quite a lot about the theory of our universe, and in fact, not only about our universe. Inflation is like a contagious disease. If it starts in one part of the universe, sometimes it stops there, but sometimes it produces new parts of the universe, which produce new parts of the universe, and that goes forever. So if we start inflation in one part of the world, and it apparently did happen very early in the universe evolution, then it may produce other parts which still continue inflating. And as a result, the universe, instead of being just an expanding sphere of fire surrounding us, instead of that, it becomes like a fractal. It's like a balloon producing new balloons, producing new balloons, producing new balloons. So the universe, once it starts expanding, it actually self-reproduces, and it self-reproduces in all its possible versions. So it produces new, effectively, as if there were separate, different universes with different laws of physics operating in them. So it's totally incredible picture. When I'm thinking about it, my head is spinning, but that's just amazing.
So, again, I'm speaking with Andre Linde, the professor of physics at Stanford University, who in 1983 was the first to describe the chaotic inflation theory, which has just been confirmed with new evidence of how the universe underwent rapid expansion a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And this evidence, of course, came from the BICEP 2 telescope at the South Pole. And there's a wonderful video of you that's on YouTube now, when a scientist from the South Pole brings the information to you and knocks on your door and tells you that your 1983 theory has been verified, and it's quite moving. You know, your wife seems to get it first, and then you sort of do a double take and then lean against the door frame like you've been hit by a bus. And then you pop the champagne corks and have a rather large glass of champagne. So.
Yeah, you know, some people even ask us whether it was staged, but no, it was a total surprise for us. We actually were working quite a lot during this year, more than even usual. And we got extremely tired. We decided that we must take 10 days of break, otherwise we will die. So we decided to fly somewhere, to swim, whatever. So we were surrounded by all of our stuff on the floor, prepared to depart. And then suddenly knock on the door, and all our dreams of happy vacation evaporate, because we take our computers with us, then we read email, then we answer questions. So life became crazy as usual. So our dream of vacation are nowhere. We're still dreaming about it.
and here I am taking up your time, right?
But that is fun. You know, it is important that as many people as possible know about the progress in physics which is achieved during last years. And this particular discovery, if it is further confirmed by other experiments, because as usual in physics, we are trying to really say only things about which we are absolutely certain. So there will be further experiments studying the same things. So if it is confirmed, it's a huge leap in the development of cosmology. I would say that this would be definitely the most important experimental result of this 21st century.
Well, you know, there's an expression in America, getting bang for the buck. So let me ask you just in closing, in terms of bang for the buck, given the billions invested at CERN and with these accelerators, et cetera, and along with, of course, the experiments in the South Pole, what do you say to people who somehow don't think that investments in science are worth it?
Okay, I will give, first of all, as for the bang for the buck, I told you that this experiment is about 1,000 times cheaper than the experiment which we had at CERN, mm-hmm. where people have found the Higgs particle. As for in general, here is one piece of news for many people who listen to you, because I do not think that many of you know that each time when you go at your iPhone and you try to find a direction in any city, or you drive your car and go to a GPS device, etc., these devices would not work properly. They would make a mistake for about 1 kilometer, if not for general theory of relativity. These calculators take into account some effects based on general theory of relativity. 100 years ago it was discovered. 100 years ago nobody expected that it would have any practical application whatsoever. And now we have it in your pocket and you cannot live. I cannot live without it. So this is just one simple example. Another example is quantum mechanics. Not many people care that these CD devices, DVD, which you play in your videos, they require lasers. And lasers are, well, product of quantum mechanics, if you wish. So if not for quantum mechanics, no music of high quality at home. So these are just examples. And these are examples of how development of science apparently not related to anything practical. Later become, well, a part of our everyday life, and we do not even notice it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Andre Linde.
Thank you for your attention.
Again, I've been speaking with Andre Linde, who's a professor of physics at Stanford University, who in 1983 was the first to describe the chaotic inflation theory, which has just been confirmed with new evidence of how the universe underwent rapid expansion a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.